for such a bear, he also was like interestingly tender in very small amounts. Like, he'd drive me to school until high school when I started like going with friends and stuff, but he would drive me to school every day and like have me kiss him on the cheek and give me a hug before he went. And it was so antithetical to everything else about him, but it was never weird. It was like into that kind of intimacy was on the table.
I'm Matthew Philp.
I'm Elizabeth Thompson.
And I'm Erin Hosier.
And this is Tell Me About Your Father, a podcast about daddy issues, father figures, and dismantling the paternal mystique.
We examine how fathers, both literal and symbolic, influence pop culture, politics, and the lives of people of every generation from all over the world.
So settle in and listen as we delve into some dad stuff.
Hi, this is Matthew. Our guest today is Alex Steed, creator, producer, and co-host of the podcast You Are Good, in which he and co-host Sarah Marshall are joined by a guest to talk about a movie from the past 40 years or so. Every week, Alex opens the episode alone in signature style, gently setting the tone by saying, "Hello, you. How are you doing? How are you feeling?" before bringing in Sarah and the guest. They then discuss a movie's larger cultural significance and how they feel about it now compared to when they first saw it. As Alex describes it, You Are Good is a podcast where we discuss movies and use that conversation to understand what it means to be a person in the world. Recent movies they've discussed include Clerks, The Virgin Suicides, and the Marvel film Logan, a film he describes as being about wall-to-wall fathers. It's an incredibly smart and funny podcast that's enjoyable to listen to whether you know the movie they're discussing or not. You Are Good launched at around the time we launched Tell Me About Your Father. At the time, it was called Why Are Dads? And it focused more explicitly on a similar subject matter to us. At a certain point, Alex and Sarah made the choice to shift focus away from fathers. They still discuss who the daddy of every film is, but it's no longer the main theme of the conversation. In addition to discussing why they made that editorial shift, in this episode, Alex talks about how he became what he calls a chaos goblin as the result of growing up with parents who never should have been together, what was behind his decision at 12 years old to live in a small town in Maine with his father, in a dynamic he describes as a 12 to 17 year old living with an old man as a roommate. We also talk about how and when he realized he's someone who finds it easiest to process the world through pop culture, and why the actor Oliver Platt is the daddy of the film Lake Placid. One quick content warning: there's a potentially confronting description in the second half of the episode where Alex describes nursing his father after an operation. You may want to skip that if you get squeamish, so I'll point it out when we get to it. And just before we dive in, if you'd like to donate resources to help children who have been impacted by the war in Gaza, we'd like to suggest that you consider giving to the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund and/or the Israeli Children's Fund. Okay, here's my conversation with Alex Steed. Alex, I'm excited to ask you this question. How are you doing? How are you feeling? Where are you living?
I'm good. I live in Los Angeles, California. And I right now am talking with you and then looking beyond the screen out at the mountains of the La Crescenta Valley.
What a shame.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible. And I love it so much. I love it so much. But I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm well. I'm looking at a glass door that is in front of a concrete pylon. So more or less the exact opposite of what you're looking at.
I was wondering what the opposite would be. You just nailed it.
Well, there it is. Yeah. I can see a sliver of a view of the whole of downtown as reflected into a glass building. Bleak. It's a sunny day, though. Anyway, you just moved to LA, right?
It's a little confusing. I lived in LA half time. I had an apartment here, and then Carolyn Kendrick, to whom I am married, and I lived in the Central Valley of California, which is about 5 hours north of Los Angeles, and we were bouncing back and forth between the two, and we've since moved to the city full time. So yeah, we just moved here full time. We've had a foot here for a while, and then I, for 15 years, have often spent at least 1 month to more in Los Angeles every year because it's somehow my favorite place.
Right, between Maine and Is it Maine or in?
I was in Maine and then Nashville for quite some time.
Okay.
Yeah, Maine had long, but sorry, my cat is. I had my birthday was yesterday.
And yes, happy birthday!
Thank you so much. And I have a carrot cake next to me,
and a carrot colored cat too.
A carrot colored cat trying to eat the cake right now. In Maine, yeah, and then in Nashville. In the past handful of years, I've lived in a lot of different places, but in theory, this is going to be the one I'm going to live in indefinitely. So I'm looking forward. Okay.
I know that moving state in particular has been a large part of your life, particularly in relation to your father. That sounds kind of obtuse, but, and I want to get to that because I know that you moved from New York to Maine in 2008, to be with your father. But just before we get to that, you have such an empathetic presence, especially I think it's a real accomplishment to create a really warm, inviting place and a podcast, which I think, and I think you do that so nicely.
Oh, thank you.
And I just wondered if that empathy is something that you have always had, or is it something that you have worked towards?
I've always had the capacity for it. I still don't necessarily know where it came from. Like, I don't know the impacts of both of my parents and sort of who and how they were, like all that stuff. But like, I do know that I have always, I feel like, had kind of an outlying understanding for people. I feel like to some degree a generosity of spirit with a lot of people. But I think that was very, very out of reach for me throughout my 20s and into my early 30s. And the show in a lot of ways was part of an endeavor to like rediscover it.
Yeah. How so? I mean, talking to people about your feelings or like, how did you see that?
I think a very long story short, I spent a good deal of my 20s drunk and, it's like, I think a lot of people do or under the influence of something. And I was very out of touch with how I was really feeling or trying to create distance between me and my feelings a lot. And then I went through this year and a half where I stopped drinking. And in doing that, I realized, a lot of stuff. I realized that the personality that I kind of created in my 20s was just a drunk guy. I didn't actually know who I was. And then I felt like I had like a really intense Saturn return time where I was like, I have to be an adult now. Like, I'm an adult. And all of these ways of floating through my life without checking in with how I was actually doing left me quite angry a lot of the time, or extremely standoffish, or like a real smartass. It's just ways that I didn't enjoy being, but I defaulted to. And then come 2018, I had this series of moments in alignment, and I started noticing who and how I was being. Who I was and how I was being. And I was like, this isn't sustainable. And to get us to our, not to prematurely get us to our subject matter, but I was like, if you don't check in on this and become a little more intentional, you're going to end up like your father.
Right. Who you have described as having resting bitch presence, which I think is quite beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. You said it with such fondness on a recent episode, and I was like, that's somebody who's really put things in perspective.
That's very true. Yeah, he was a real, he was actually like quite funny in a lot of ways, but he also could be uncomfortable to be in a room with him if you fell on a different side of an issue.
How old was he? What generation is he?
What we call the silent generation. I don't know if that's a...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a sort of, everyone calls it that, but the
they oddly enough made themselves very well known for a silent generation.
They were very present. Yeah, yeah.
Very, very, very strong with the virtue signaling.
He's it was an extremely different personality type and class type, but like, he and Don Draper were just extraordinarily similar disposition. Like, Don Draper to me is the most quintessential silent generation white man guy, you know, and they had a similar disposition with regard to feeling their feelings.
So how did it come? Because I mean, his feelings had to come out somehow. So how did they, you know what I mean?
Totally. Usually, I think usually explosively, he was not physically violent with me. There were maybe a handful of times where he made his physical presence known. I mean, it would be in ways that would be seen as completely unacceptable in parenting today, but like in the context of friends of mine who had like physically abusive parents, it was not that. But he was either explosive, he was a yeller, not a screamer, just like a loud guy. And that's a thing I really have to work on, not yelling because I don't do that, but like being loud and passionate when I feel a particular way. I realize as a person who is 6'5" and a man, it's like you gotta like chill about
I know what you mean.
Know what I mean? And so that's that actually increasingly in the past decade has made me pursue I think even more of like a softness, because I was like, you know, from learning how he was in that way. And then the other way he would be when feeling a feeling is withdrawal, you know. So he would go just quiet for a couple of days. And he was like, you knew you were on the wrong side of something, but you weren't entirely sure what, and you were sure you would find out eventually, but you had to kind of suffer through it until then.
Everything's about enacting dominance in some way. I'm gonna control the mood of the house. I'm gonna win. I'm the one who, you know. Yeah,
it's like what the structure just becomes a default. I don't even know how much of happens in not intentionally but by design. Like people fall into their structure, people fall into the structural trappings. And for him, you know, I think, and I've seen this happen with a lot of different people, where they think, this happened with me, I'm sure, is that like you think that you, it's an environment that you're creating where it's like anyone can say anything they want. And it's like, no, they can't.
Yeah.
you have created intentionally or otherwise a structure that is difficult to impossible to penetrate in a meaningful way.
Yeah. Did he drink, or was he? Did he have?
He was a former drinker.
Okay.
He was a what would be referred to in the secret societies as a dry drunk. He did not drink. Like maybe 10 times in my whole life, I saw him like drink a beer at like a family event, and that is all he did. But he had his own personal legend about experiencing some gnarly drunk driving accident and then giving up drinking then. And, you know, it was like a real triumphant story in which he was the hero, but he didn't do any of the work. He just found another place for all of that frustration and series of feelings out of control.
So then when you had Saturn returns, what was that, like 27, 28? Is that about right? Yeah, that's about when it apparently happens to everybody, when you suddenly have to be an adult.
Right. Or you have to be something and you're not sure what.
Yeah. Or somehow life smacks you down in a way where it's like, you don't actually know what you're talking about. Did you think about your drinking at that point? And was that because of him?
I had a drunk driving. I crashed my car into another car at an intersection. It was a minor, I'm not justifying it, I should not have been. I had a little fender bender, and they got out and were drunk too. And that we all looked and we were like, looks good. And then we left. And
wow.
It was the luckiest. It was so lucky on every front. I mean, primarily it's lucky that no one got killed. Primarily it's lucky that I did not get killed. It's lucky that I didn't have to get involved in the criminal justice system for that thing. I was so lucky. Yeah. And it was a real moment of, and then I had just read at the same time The Shining, I think the immediately beforehand, which at the end of the day, the monster in that is alcoholism. And I was like, I gotta fucking get it under control or bad things are gonna happen. And that's how I started, because once you start doing work and stuff on that, you know, that's when you start probably for the first time in a lot of people's lives, talking about like family structure stuff. And that's when I started to understand him more.
How so?
I had a lot more sympathy for, once I understood, I think, like a lot of the ways that he was weren't by choice. He was just stuck in trappings that he was never given tool sets for, and maybe would have gotten some tool sets had he gone to something like AA, although I could never in a million years see a world in which he would have voluntarily gone. But like, yeah, it made me realize a lot of the ways that we end up are so almost oppressively, systemically predetermined that when you're able to sort of unpack that on your own behalf, you can then ideally at least give other people the benefit of the doubt, assuming that they're in the same position.
Were you doing this in therapy?
Oh, I've been a big...
As am I, as you know, totally.
Therapy guy. Yeah. For a while, I had a nervous breakdown when I was 17, and my parents didn't know. I had it at a college dorm when I was at a party, and it was not great. And my parents didn't know. I was just kind of like not in and around the house, so there wasn't like resources to help with that at the time anyway, like within the house. And then my parents were terrified of the idea of me talking to a therapist. So I sought out, I love the kid that did this, because I don't even know how he came to do this, but I found a therapist at 17 and started talking with them by myself. And it was like there was community resources somehow. It was a sliding scale, so I was able to afford it. And I have since been in and out of therapy since 17.
What form did that take? You're at a party. How do you, people say I had a nervous breakdown. I'm always kind of.
Oh, I was. I was dating a woman who went to this college. She was a year older than me. So she was in her freshman year and I was a senior. And she started to see. It was clear she started to see somebody else.
Okay.
And I saw something that indicated that that was the case. And I just essentially was like babbling. It felt like I broke with reality. And then I, you know, slumped into bawling. And I felt like an actual kind of, the way that I remember describing it that has stayed with me in therapy was I was like, it felt like all of my thoughts and feelings, I typically put them into a filing cabinet, and then that filing cabinet exploded. And what had happened is I just reached the end of being able to compartmentalize. And I've since now I know people I've seen go through similar things. And I'm like, I think I know what you're going through and where you're at. But the thing that I've since unpacked since that for years and years and years and stuff is I had such a wildly intense fear of abandonment. And I think it was like, you know, that was triggered in me at 17. It unpacked and touched on every other feeling I had related to that. And I was, you know, I think that sometimes you're forced to confront your feelings, whether or not you want to, and if you don't do it intentionally, it's going to happen in an unintentional way. And I think I was.
What role are your parents playing in your life around this time? Like, are you a typical teenager where you're like really separated from them, but you're kind of still dependent on them? Like, how aware of that? They're obviously shocked and don't want you to see a therapist, but
so when I was 12, which would have been 1996 or 1997, doesn't matter, it was around then, and this is for I'll be able to illustrate this fear of abandonment thing beautifully in the situation is it was announced to me, so we lived in Maine, we moved to Maine when I was 5 from a Boston suburb, and then 12, so from the 6th to the 7th grade, my parents are like, we're going to move back to Everett, Massachusetts, which is where we were from. And I was like, great, sounds great. And I can't wait, actually, because I've been told by my parents over and over that we are living in a lesser situation by living in Maine than we were when we were living outside of Boston. So can't wait. Let's go do it. And so we move down and we get there and start moving out. And then my dad's just like, well, all right, see you later. And he drives back to Maine and he just lives in Maine. And no one told me. And I still kind of don't understand what this was, but like, it was like a soft launch of a separation.
Oh, not of their divorce or
like... Of their divorce, yeah.
Okay.
And no one, it was never sort of acknowledged directly. And then maybe like 6 weeks later, you know, my mom was like, oh, your dad wants to talk with you. And she gave me the phone and he said that cliche thing. He just kept repeating the cliche of, we just want you to know this isn't your fault. This isn't your fault. This isn't your fault. But no one told me what wasn't my fault. And so I had this like very disorienting, for that reason and then another number of other reasons, I had a very disorienting year 12, or my personal age of 12. And eventually told my mom, I was like, I want to move back to Maine. And I think I would not have wanted to move back to Maine had this not been such a like a disorienting thing. But I was like, I want to move back to Maine. So I went to go back to live with my father, who is a full generation older. I was born when he was 53. And I went to go live with him in Maine, and he was kind of a single parent from that point on. And so he did not know how to raise a child.
What was the draw for you? Like, why were you like, my dad? That's who I want
to... Well, it was not my dad. It was not my dad. It was Maine. It was okay. That it was that this, again, had I kind... Well, I don't... I have no... Whatever. Things happen the way that they happen. But I kind of wish in some ways that the family dynamic of that move wasn't so messed up, because I think I would have actually enjoyed transitioning to the school system that I transitioned to and like staying in and around the Boston area. I think I could have actually benefited from that in a lot of ways. But I think that, you know, I was so disoriented by this thing that happened that I wanted something that was close to a normal that I used to know. And so I think that I picked living in Maine. And they assume that I picked living with him. And it's like, no, like I actually would have preferred to live with my mother. But
yeah,
that whole process had become such a symbol of disorientation. At least being back in a familiar place was handy.
And how emotionally capable was she? I mean, she's playing a part in this, like, oh, well.
She was emotionally incapable in different ways. We have a great relationship now, but it took a long time. And it took a long time for me. I resented her for a long time because I think that I didn't realize that like she wasn't making the choice. Like everyone was doing the best they could with the worst toolkit that they had.
Right. Great.
And so it felt like she left, but that's not what happened at all. Two people who should never have been together in the first place in that way ran up against a wall, and they tried to figure out how they could best do it, but didn't have any of the necessary toolkits. And now we've since talked about stuff around it to a point where I feel like we you know, we're just like, well, we appreciate that we were doing the best we could at the time.
Yeah, right.
Hopefully you carry lessons forward.
So, because you've got a younger brother, I know.
I have a younger brother through marriage, yes.
Okay. Oh, I see. So. Mm. Not so you're an only child.
I'm an only full child on my mom's side, and my dad has five half siblings above me, but I was never raised in the house with any of them.
Okay, so you're doing this alone.
Yep.
Okay. I mean, you
or anyone who I can sucker into being a part-time family member. Yeah, but mostly
right. Yeah.
Yeah, I've been trying. You know, construct a family since.
It's funny how that is just the end result of being raised by silent generation or baby boomers.
Well, you make a lot of people your, you find, you know, Mark Maron on his show, often it'll come up where he'll ask people, you know, who is your guy, and the your guy in that situation is often the person who's like, it's not gendered, but like, who is your guy? It's often the person who's like, an older sibling, but if not, it's an older person who is your gateway to like the actual world.
Right.
I made a life of trying to find those people.
Even though you ostensibly lived with the person who was supposed to be that for you. In where? Exactly. Like, what kind of a place? Is it like, are we talking rural Maine? Like, how?
We're talking, so the town that I grew up in has a population of 1,200 people.
Okay.
The region that is represented in the high school has at most 4,000 people. So it's like 4,000 people, but like 200 square miles or something.
Wow. Okay.
And my high school was so small that it also included the eighth grade, and eighth through 12th was 430 students.
What kind of effort did your dad put in? Like, what was his reaction that you wanted to come stay with him? And then, like, how did he operate as a parent around you, given that he had largely no skills at that?
He didn't try any.
He's just like, see you next week.
He was retired at this point too. So he was like kind of around. Fortunately, he was like moderately active in that he would always be involved in, like, he had always had giant gardens, and like he had a radiator repair shop that he would occasionally do some work. But he would be busy, but he was also technically retired. It's inaccurate in some ways, but I've described the time as like it was like a 12 to 17 year old with an old man as a roommate who occasionally thought that he had to be in charge, like emotionally. Emotionally is not the right term, but like, in there was no sense of like what being in charge would actually look like. He just needed to know who was like boss in an argument. He wasn't like he didn't have like a school of parenting, or like he wasn't like, you know, you got to do this with kids or this will happen. Like, he had no idea. He was flying by the seat of his pants.
Because do you know like how he was parented? Do you think maybe?
Yeah, he was. I was just remembering this with Carolyn the other day, where she asked if I had ever met my grandmother on his side. I did once. So I know my grandfather was off the boat Scottish. I think she might have been as well. And she was an extremely cold woman. And my grandfather, who I never met because he passed by the time that I came around, but my grandfather was like beloved by the family for being like a warm, loving, funny, like all of this stuff. And my understanding is she was very cold. And now, in, you know, I mean, obviously I have very little data. I don't know like what was actually happening in that situation, but I do feel like I do know.
Alex's microphone faded at this exact moment for just a second, and it cut him off, saying that his father couldn't wait to join the Navy to get away from home. It's an important point.
I don't fully know what it was, but I do know like he loved his dad and had an extremely tense relationship with his mom.
Oh, hi, Aaron here. This is just a quick reminder that your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts really help us to keep bringing you unforgettable conversations and continuous pop culture reporting. It only takes a second. Go to podcast.apple.com or via your phone app, click the stars and tell us what you think. Thank you. And now back to the show.
Just going back to your trajectory. So you're in Maine, you have this nervous breakdown, you have therapy. At what point do you decide to move to New York?
The other side of all of this stuff with my dad is I go move in with my dad, and he starts to have a series of like illnesses. And starting when I'm starting this year that I go back to Maine, it's maybe a little bit before that, I can't quite remember, but it's discovered that he has a tumor in his bladder that I think was related to his military service. And it's not cancerous, but it can become cancerous. And so he has that. And then at when I'm 15, he has lung cancer and then has to have half of a lung removed. And then the bladder thing comes back and then that metastasis. There's a whole, like, it's from I think like 10, no, from 12 on when I'm living there. I could die and here's what you should know. That is the parenting that he did.
I see.
Was he was like, I could die and you should know X, Y, and Z if I do. Here's where there's some cash. Like, here's like, it was like apocalypse. It was like being raised by an apocalypse person. Like, here's like some cash. Don't talk to these people. Like, do that. Like, it was a very funny, not funny, but
it sounds exhausting.
It was exhausting for sure. But as a result, this is a thing I don't think was intentional. I think like my father was my primary source of, you know, and this is aligned a lot with the drinking stuff, but like was my primary source of like understanding like codependent family structures, because like I think he was in a lot of ways, without ever asking for it or without even being conscious of it, there was a collective expectation, because I had these half siblings who were around as well, that I would be the person who takes care of me. In a way that was not conscious for years or on the surface for years. It took a while. It was in retrospect that I realized it, but that created in me an unwillingness to go very far from me, because I would be inevitably called back at some point to go deal with it. And so I eventually went to New York. I worked for like the Democratic Party a little bit and like worked for some politics jobs and stuff. But I had reached out to some magazines via Craigslist, and like in absolutely just like the craziest you gotta do this way, literally the first person I emailed cold emailed me back, and it was my arts and entertainment editor from my college newspaper that I worked at when I was in high school.
Right.
And she was like, oh, come down and work this internship. And I went and worked for free magazine.
Another thing we have in common. Wow.
Yeah.
In exactly the same way almost too.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
Then I worked at a cafe to go broke on top of that.
Yeah, right. It's not exactly cheap. It's not affordable to be an intern unless you're a trust fund kid.
No. Yeah, you learned that real hard for sure.
There must have been a lot of resentment towards your dad. He's saying, I may die, here are where the, you know, documents, and here's the cash at any minute. Are you resentful towards him?
No, I don't think I don't think I ever was. I just felt chaotic the entire time. Like, I just felt one step from absolute chaos the entire time. From 12 to 30.
Yeah.
I just felt like I just had dinner with Jeannie Finley, who is the director of the documentary Your Fat Friend, and she was in LA here. We had dinner and she was like, everything in LA, but also just in the United States, she's like, everything feels precarious. And I was like, and it was like such a great way to describe like exactly what my childhood felt like.
It's like, welcome to my world. Yeah,
yeah. 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 Everything feels like one step away from a total unraveling. And I think that shaped so much of my behavior and engagement with the world, both from a like risky chaos goblin standpoint, which I think I was for quite some time. And I think I acted out in a lot of ways because to like kind of like make up for the fact that I realized that I also wasn't flexing very much, because I couldn't go very far away because I was tethered to this situation. But yeah. I never blamed him. I actually, even when I was like frustrated by ways that he was and found him extraordinarily difficult in 100 different ways, I think I always felt a little. And he was so like such a presence and like such a like a big person. But like, I think I always felt a little bad for him.
Right. I guess what would it take to be resentful of somebody who's constantly worried they're about to die of cancer? I mean,
Yeah.
Unless you knew they weren't really, and it was a fake situation.
Right, right. Well, I think also just like, I still don't know why I was so like abstract and like structure and system minded from like a young age, but like my primary concern, you know, who do I not like the most in this situation is like the military. Wait a minute, situation where you had. Now I know that my dad was impossible to live with, was the reason why they had to go in two different ways, because he's not going to grow in any particular way. Now I have enough information to like A, exonerate my mom, but B, realize that you know, the situation was like even more impossible than I initially.
And a lot of women didn't leave those situations of her generation. Sure. You know, there's something quite admirable in a way, because there's so little stability for women.
Oh yeah, know. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I love my mom so much, but we, you know, she's spent a good deal of her life. Her dad sucked. Her dad was bad dad. And she spent all of her adult life, I think, trying to find a new dad and partners.
Right.
For partner after partner. And so we, you know, we're all pretty on the nose about how we respond to our situations.
Yeah. It's always disappointing when you look at yourself and you're like, God, what a cliched response.
Oh, God, absolutely. And I've been there on my own behalf many times.
So you're in New York and you're bohemianing it and you're writing and, you know, and then I only know this because I did research, but you find out he has cancer, but this time it's not.
It's not going away. It's bad.
So how does that play out? Like, does he call you about this, or?
I was just talking about this the other night. I almost forget that I did this sometime. I think it was 2008 because it was Obama election year. I went on this like self-designed research road trip blog multimedia thing called Millennials Changing America. I was working for change.org and eventually Groupon, or the company that would become Groupon as it's becoming Groupon. I was working at those places and I find myself at tech conferences and I heard people talking about like Gen Y at that time. And I was like, all of this seems wrong. Like all of what they're saying seems wrong. So I went on this tour and drove to 35 different cities, I think in 60 days, saw the country, kind of making up for lost time. And in San Francisco, I remember I was there. I remember the calls I'd have with him. You know, it sounded like he was a little panicked that I was that far away. And it was starting to kind of become evident that we were finding ourselves in a place where reinforcements were required.
Okay.
And, you know, again, like he never said it, but it was becoming evident that was the thing that was needed.
And so then what's the crux point at which you
know, I can't even remember, to be honest, I can't even remember. I just know that it was like when I stopped being able to show up for work, in one way or another, like because I was so focused on, you know, are you going to this appointment, is this thing happening, or like my ability not to literally show up for work, but to like keep my boss's hat.
It became
evident that I needed to go home. And then so I went back to Maine, was, you know, essentially like a live-in caregiver for him for quite some time. I did a little contract. I mean, some of my bosses were helpful as much as they could be. I did a little contracting from afar. But not enough to sustain. And then I just lived on credit cards and went into a massive amount of debt.
Sure. Right.
And also when he passed in 2009, I inherited his house, but his house had a debt, a lien on it from the state health coverage he was getting. So I had a house, a bunch of credit card debt, no income, and a debt from the state that kind of became shackles on me for a couple of years before I got that resolved. So the whole right. situation was just grandly disoriented.
Well, and not just that. I mean, when you're in New York City and you somehow land and somehow find a way to exist, it seems, speaking of, everything feels precarious. It's sort of like, I'm not sure if you had this experience, but it always felt like I had a kind of reserved, I had this spot I was taking up. And if I ever left it, someone would take my spot.
For sure.
And yeah, so
someone got my spot.
Right. So, but you had to make that decision to give up your spot to a certain extent. I guess you're still freelancing remotely.
Yeah, a little bit, but not real. I mean, it was evident that New York was done for a while.
Okay. Well, so that was a clear decision that you made. You weren't like,
I don't think I've made a clear decision until I was 35. That was as clear a decision.
Fair that enough.
I decided, God, I don't even know how to articulate this, but like it was just decided. No one decided it for me. I didn't decide it. It was like, who else is going to do it? And who else is going to do it has become one of my biggest enemies of a assumption. Is that, you know, I'm often thinking, because I was forever in a situation where it's, who else is going to do it? I'll do it. Fuck it. I'll do it. Someone's going to do it. Someone's going to keep this shit together. Like that has become such a massive thing I've needed to unlearn through therapy for years now. But that's what decided it. Who else is going to?
Yeah, I guess you're kind of Robinson Crusoe so much in all of this that like you, yeah, like who else is going to do it? There's no one. I got to take care of this or it's not going to happen.
Right. And then it turns out, and then a lot of times, and that, which makes sense in situations where that's actually what you're facing, which I was facing. But then you get into like, you know, relationships and stuff. You're like, who else is going to do it? And no, it's like, no one's asking you.
Right. Yeah. It's
no one needs you to do the thing. Exactly. Yeah. No one needs you to do the things that you think are, you know, or no one is out of, those are the things that you need to unlearn. But that was all of my learning how to interface with the world and other people was defined by essentially having to parent myself from 12 on. And it's an extremely unhealthy way to learn how to relate to people.
Yeah, like who's going to iron all of these sheets if I don't do it? You know,
exactly.
We and couldn't then they're like, possibly oh, sleep on unironed sheets. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, why are you being weird? It's like, someone needs to iron all these sheets.
And then they're like, oh, sure. Just step into this room and sit down for a minute.
Exactly. Exactly.
But it's like
high strung.
You know, well, that's, you know, I mean, it's not shocking to me, I guess. You're just like, my dad has cancer, I'm out, bye. But so then you're there, you're back with him.
Yeah.
So one of my friend's father had cancer, and my friend moved back in with his father and, you know, ended up kind of having to bathe him and he talked about the physical contact that he ended up having in a way that he'd never really had with his father before. And a lot of it was incredibly confronting.
Sure.
But in some ways he was deeply grateful for that intimacy, you know, the brutality of watching somebody die of something as awful as cancer. I mean, aside, how did being in that situation and having to take care of him until the end, like, evolve your relationship, if that's the right word?
Oh, no, totally. It's like the beginning of my father. I will say in this way that I can't even quite understand it, where it came from. I should ask my siblings. I still talk to you about this. This also created some fissures between me and some of the siblings. There are ones who I adore and still get along with. He was, for such a bear, he also was like interestingly tender in very small amounts. Like, he'd drive me to school until high school when I started like going with friends and stuff, but he would drive me to school every day and like have me kiss him on the cheek and give me a hug before he went. And it was so antithetical to everything else about him. But it was never weird. It was that kind of intimacy was on the table in ways that were extremely countered by the rest of his behavior. But I bring that because I don't want to suggest that there was no intimacy in the house.
Right. Yeah.
When I say that this was just an opening the floodgates to intimacy, because there is, as you said, as you talked about with your friend, and it's very much my experience as well. I remember at 15 when he had half of a lung removed.
So this is the part I mentioned at the beginning that gets visceral, in which Alex describes having to respond to an unexpected complication that occurred with his father after that operation. If you don't want to hear the details, skip ahead 1 minute and 12 seconds.
For people who don't know what that surgery is like, you picture a knife going right under your shoulder blade and then going down around your rib cage all the way down, and then back up, essentially circling back up to your nipple. And that's, they cut you open. It looks like the biggest shark bite you've ever seen, the size of what you imagine a shark to be. And it absolutely decimates the structural integrity of your body. And he, a couple of nights after that surgery happened, his stitching started to come undone, and essentially his body started to open up like a Nightmare Before Christmas character. And I had to essentially squeeze him and tape him back together so he could drive to a hospital to have him.
Yeah.
And that really changes the power dynamic of your relationship with your parents.
Right. Yeah.
In a lot of ways, whatever physical intimidation happened before, out the window. That's kind of a blessing to have, yeah, in some ways. I think a lot of people imagine it's like the fight Kevin finally has with his father in Iron Claw. You
right.
Get to finally sort of swing at your dad, but fortunately life swung at my dad in this case, and I had to help clean.
You didn't even have to do it. You got the win in the end.
Exactly. And then the other thing that this what I truly consider to be a gift in a broader, more universal way is I wish it didn't happen the way it did. I was in debt for years, not because of my father, but because of how this country deals with healthcare. I don't resent him in any way for those things. I think that these are all structural issues that ended up happening. We are just now having conversations about generational trauma. No one had the tools. I don't blame. And I'm grateful for the gift of intimacy with death.
Yeah.
Because I'm not scared of death. And haven't been since then. It's not a mystery. I think most people are scared of a mystery, they're scared of actual death. And it was certainly demystified in a tremendous way.
I mean, how so?
I don't know. I just remember feeling, there's a couple of moments just in my life that I felt like my entire makeup was remixed in some way. And this was one of those moments. On the other side of it, I just feel like I was I'm not scared of that. I'm scared of a lot of other things. I'm scared of people I love leaving me.
Fair.
I'm not scared of, a car accident. I'm scared of other things that I haven't learned how to reconcile, but I've become so intimate with the body's fallibility. And then when my dad died, I sat with his body and held his dead hand and, all these things that I think, had you laid them out to me a year before and we were like, you're going to be sitting in a room at some point with this corpse of your father and have his hand in your hand, I don't think I could have processed. And then right. Suddenly you have to process all that stuff every day.
Yeah.
And I truly, I do think that the majority of our fear of a lot of things is them being a mystery. And I'm not saying that death isn't still, I still don't know what happens on the other side of it. I'm not suggesting
right.
it, but so much of the things I saw in caregivers all have this in common in one way or another, is like I saw so many things that my, not only did life not prepare me for, but life was like actively tried to get me to never think. And I saw that all up close. I saw it with him, and then we had that in common. Like we had his dying in common, and that was a shared experience that we had.
How did he think of death, knowing that it was coming?
He just didn't. He was like impatient even with death. He found it tedious. You know, I know like a couple of people tried to get him into Jesus and stuff, and he wasn't. There was a chaplain. I had forgotten about this entirely until now, but there was a chaplain who eventually we were in home hospice care, and then he went to a hospice, which is where, and then he written, it was not as welcome, but he kept coming back in the hospice. Then he had to go to an end of life, not an end of life center, but a nursing. And that's where he finally passed. Unfortunately, I really wish he passed at the hospice. I think it would have been a better trip for him. But when he was under the care of the hospice, particularly at home, they sent a chaplain, like interfaith chaplain, to be like, to essentially like initiate a conversation with him to find out there were things that were scary or unknown or whatever. And I've seen him have more patience for like door-to-door religious salesmen, like meaning like people who are trying to get you to like join the Jehovah's Witnesses or something.
Yeah.
He could not have entertained her curiosity less. He just was clearly annoyed, and she left. And in retrospect, I realized like he wasn't annoyed. He was just terrified. Like, and just didn't know how to be terrified.
Sure. Because it seems like, I think from what I know about this process, there was a play about it, Dana H, that was on a few years ago, where it was the woman whose job it was to help people to die. And she said that people often need just to know that it's okay to die. They'll hold on. There's a certain amount of will you actually do have.
Right.
You can exert over.
Right.
Death, where once somebody knows that their kids or their family will be okay for real and they're reassured, then they can let go, but they can't let go until they know that. And like aristocrats, in a more sort of silly way, seem to decide when they die. You know, a monarch's going to die in England when they move to the country.
It's so funny you say that. I was at a bar the other day, getting oysters. It was like the hour before my birthday, and I was like, I'm gonna get myself some oysters. And there was a woman, a very young woman, sitting next to me, and she was engrossed in a book. And I was like, what are you reading? She turns around, it was Tom Robbins' Jitterbug Perfume.
Okay.
Which is about exactly that, which is about, essentially like a religious and regional leader who finds his first gray hair, and he knows sort of through their process that means he'll soon be put out to pasture. And I was like, if you don't mind, how old are you? She was like, I'm 26. And I was like, you're going to really like this book so much. She's like, I like it so much. I was like, this book is going to haunt you for the rest of your life. Because I think, increasingly I think about Jitterbug Perfume and meditation on aging and virility and when it's time to go and it's time to let, even if you're not going to die, like when it's time to let go of things you thought were important. All of, but yeah, the whole relocation is a huge part of that.
Pivoting actually in a sort of perhaps clumsy way. Your podcast, You Are Good, was originally called Why Are Dads? And it focused more explicitly on fathers. Can you talk about why you shifted focus?
So the show started as a show called Apocalypse Friends.
Okay.
And that we never released any episodes, but we recorded a bunch of episodes. And the idea was we are two people who love each other and love movies and are going through, it's August of 2020, are going through a seemingly unprecedented for a while event that felt apocalyptic. And so we were like, let's talk about movies that are about like apocal times where there's some big transition happening. And sometimes they're literally apocalyptic. Sometimes it's about just sort of going from one thing into another. And we just got four episodes in and we were like, it's too much. That's too much.
Too much disaster.
To do. Yeah. And we're already dealing with it. And then so we were like, well, we like the model. Let's pivot to demystifying another thing that's extremely difficult, which is our relationships with our fathers, because both Sarah and I have old dads. And our cold old dads, I would say. And then I think I can't remember how many episodes we were in, maybe 40 by the time we changed, like we weren't a full year in, and we changed it to You Are Good Because. And so the idea of Why Our Dads is we'd watch a movie and we would like do a lot of the stuff that we're talking about right now, like unpack sort of masculinity, unpack the ways that that systems of patriarchy sort of have impact or effect on it, whatever. Unpack our relationships with people. And usually in most movies, it's a dad. It's like always sort of a dad based relationship, because these, you know, Wilhelm Reich would point out fascist structure was cooked up in the patriarchal family system. Right. So these are just around, and these are things we talk about. But then I think we realized, well, two things happened. One, we realized that what we were really talking about was like how we as humans relate to other humans. Like that's ultimately it. And a lot of time dad stuff comes up. And the other thing was we realized that there were people who wanted to engage the show who could not get their head around who had their own dad drama and trauma stuff, and they did not want to sit through what they thought was just dad trauma.
That's exactly the feedback we get. And yeah, it's not often about that. Often, it's oddly enough, most of the stories are actually not sad and terrifying.
Totally. But yeah, we wanted to make it clear that you were going to get something else out of it. And yeah, and dad stuff is so heavy that... And I'm kind of up to your minds about it. I'm glad we did. I love how the show is, and I love what we
do. Me too, yeah. It's great.
But at the same time, I do, like, I think that there are people who are like, I do need to work through my dad stuff. And so I would like to hear explicit conversations about that. So
if you do touch on it in every episode where you identify the dad of each film, yes, which is a really fun part of it. You said recently on an episode that one of the only ways that you can process humanity, your own humanity, is through pop culture. When I hear that, I was like, it sounds like a trauma response. I don't mean to put it into a realm of pain and, you know, whatever, but it does sound like a very American response too, I think. Where did you find that out about yourself? Like, a mutual listener of ours asked me specifically to ask you this question. Like, what is the piece of art, music, literature that made you go, oh my God, I get it. That makes sense to me. This changed my life. This changed the way I see the world, how I process being a human.
Sure. It's so funny. I have a newsletter that I never actually do anything with. And I had decided that I wanted to profile all of the like tastemakers in my life, like the people who were influential in one way or another along those lines, right down to like, I had a video production company that I sold to my partner a couple years ago, and a person who I'd hired to take over for me when I left had left the company before I'd sold. And she said to me, sorry, this is such a roundabout way to get to this answer, but she said to me, she's like, you don't belong at this company. You're a creative person. Like, you need to be making creative work. Like, this is, you running a company is not the way for you to. And that was one of the last big gifts I was giving by somebody. It was given permission to whatever. But I was thinking about a long line of the different kinds of people who've intervened. And for me, so to get to your actual question, the biggest one is Ghostbusters, not because of the art that it was or because of the media or whatever, but because it was the first, I remember saying, I was like five, and I was talking to my Uncle Phil, five or six, and someone had got me like a Ghostbusters, like one of those books that's like, it's like just like shots from the movie, and then there's like information about the movie, and there's like like kind of like a story, but then there's stuff about actors and stuff like that. I remember saying to my uncle, I was like, Peter Venkman is played by Bill Murray. Louis Tully is played by Rick Moranis. Like I like ran through like who the people were, then who the actors were, like whatever. And it was the first thing that I could consciously see from a handful of dimensions. Like I could see the text, I could see what was behind the text, I could start to understand and like surmise context. And that just from that point on became my frame for understanding everything, to a point where like now, and I don't know how much of this is like a neurodivergent whatever, but I don't know if this is that, but like I always am in any conversation and actively processing it on three or four different levels. I'm like actively processing the text and the subtext and sort of like what I'm bringing to it and what the other person's bringing to it. And sometimes I don't know what to do with all of the thoughts that I'm having at once, particularly when it comes to being able to relate to other people. And so using pop culture as a text to fill in for some of the signifiers that I don't have other binaries for, that's how that's been functioning in my life since. But like Ghostbusters was the first one, and then Freddy Krueger and Nightmare on Elm Street, knowing that that was a man named Robert Englund, and knowing a man named Wes Craven made, and knowing Heather Langenkamp played, you know, like all of that stuff then gave me, kind of without my knowing it at the time, a model for understanding, you know, consciousness, unconscious. It was the most accessible form of that I would then apply to everything else.
What was your dad's take on that, do you think?
I think he was mystified, right, with my interest in these forms of culture. I will say, with the exception of like heavy metal panic stuff, not satanic panic sort of thing, but just like, this is gauche.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Or this is like objectively bad art. They shouldn't swear that much, stuff like that. He aside from that, he had no judgment on what I liked, which is actually kind of nice. And then also, like any kid, that boy that liked media in that particular way, I got really into Goodfellas, so I brought that to him, and he had spent time, you know, making money in nefarious ways in the 60s, so you know, he had some frames of reference for that, and he would talk about that.
He's like reading the authenticity of Goodfellas, like that never would have happened.
Yeah, truly. And we did have these pieces of culture that we could relate over. Like then when Saving Private Ryan came out, obviously that was huge, particularly with American service members. So we watched that, and there were these, you know, some pop culture was helpful, and that it gave us. This honestly is the first time I've thought about this, but like he. Truly with him, it was the first difficult relationship that common denominator helped facilitate some closeness that otherwise wouldn't have existed.
Yeah. And it's funny, in so many contexts, people I think look at pop culture as being kind of trashy or lowbrow, no matter what it is.
Sure.
And then the way that it can function for you in this incredibly human way. And most people, I think, I mean, it's everything. It's funny how it has a bad rap often, because there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure, in my opinion.
No one's going to remember you for good taste.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like no one remembers you. Like no one, what's his name? Oscar Wilde. Like, I mean, like there's like
Princess Diana and her fashion, but that's it. That's the only two people. That's it.
There's like 10 people in all of history who are most known for good taste. So like, no one gives a shit about the flavor of what you relate to or with. And an ideology that our show tries to, and I am a snob in a lot of ways, to be truly a snob in many ways, but for the purposes of our show and for the purpose of the conversation we have around our show, we are like, we are not here to judge these things in this way. And honestly, I am doing that as much for my younger self as anything else, because I think a lot of times I thought that the ways I related to the world were juvenile and without value, or were inherently trashy. And so in pretending that I was above them, I wasn't actually processing.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that, like, by us doing that in a less judgmental way, and we and our friends at this end at prom, it's another movie show. You know, we believe in and espouse that there's no low culture.
Yeah,
I believe that there is low culture, but I don't. I'm just kidding. But like I do. I mean, I do have a snobbery about the Twinkies. Stuff that I like. Yeah, Twinkies for sure. Do you have a snobbery about the stuff that I like, but I acknowledge that that's a construct that I'm falling
into. Yeah, 100%. Totally. Yeah. Speaking of your show, one of the things I really love, and it's something we used to do a show called Daddy Issues, where we would talk about, like, in the last week, who or what wasn't your dad. So it's like, you know, the wind in the Suez Canal was my dad one time, because I'm like, no one got hurt. And she was just showing up to, you know. And like wine gums were my, you know, like, so it can be broadly interpreted. For every episode you do, you'll talk about a film, and then you get to the end and you ask Sarah, your co-host, and your guest, who was the dad in this for you? Who's the daddy in this for you? How do you define that? I mean, I get a sense of it. It's not unclear, but I just wanted to know how you specifically define it. Yeah.
Well, I have no standard definition for it. The way that it's meant these days, particularly since it's always funny because, like, we'll have people on who've never listened to the show and they don't know that our show used to be called Why Are Dads and why we ask this random question at the end. I always describe it as, like, it's meant to be like a bit of a Rorschach test where,
yeah, totally,
where we say, you define daddy however you want. And we, it used to strictly be thirsty, you know, it used to strictly be like, who is the daddy?
Hottest middle-aged man, right? Yeah.
Yes, precisely. And then it pretty quickly became, how, you know, is it an aspirational dad? Is it like someone who illustrates the best ways to dad? And sometimes that's not gendered. Is it someone was so quintessential in the ways that they did not come through that is the way that they're attempting?
So that's interesting. We have the same exact basic gravitational force in terms of defining who isn't, right, and who is. So right. I wondered if you could tell me, who was your dad in the world when it comes to Los Angeles?
Oh, what a cool question. That's a super cool question. This person, so here it is. I know it. It's last year, I needed to know how to do live streaming mechanics stuff. So I reached out to my friend Jason, who I met through doing a podcast. I reached out to him and I was like, hey, can you teach me a bit about live stream? He's like, yeah, come on down to the studio. And I didn't know what I was walking into. I had no idea what I was walking into. I went down to the studio and it was Tom Sharpling's show, The Best Show, which is like the grandfather of podcast. I mean, Tom Sharpling was doing this not as a podcast, you know, on terrestrial radio, in going back to 1990. And I went in, again, having no idea that that's what I was walking into. Tom comes out to the waiting room and he's like, there's Alex Steed's laugh. And he sees me and, like, clearly, like, he had heard my show. Just cascading. It's blowing my mind. Like, everything about this is blowing my mind, one thing after another. And I kept seeing Tom Sharpling in randomly for like a week. I just kept seeing him in different places. I saw him at a haunted hayride. Then he invited me to come to his Halloween party, which was like a big deal. And and then in so many ways, and I'm not like in regular touch with Tom at all, but through this week and then through being on that show and through sort of meeting people through him, whatever, he has become like the ground zero of my entire social experience here.
Right.
And he birthed, you know, this series of experiences I've been having for the past year and a half, or no, this is just 6 months now, that helped shape how the past, you know, how at least the beginning of this year has looked for me. And now sort of a number of people that I know and like and appreciate and admire came from in one way or another that time. And ultimately Jason Gore, who was the one who invited me down to check to go check out the studio. But yeah, in a lot of ways, like, interesting. And this is not surprising. There's like a number of people who they're one degree away from Tom Sharpling in one way or another in this town. He has been instrumental in that way, in a way that I don't think that he would even have any idea that that's how I feel.
That is amazing, especially for Los Angeles, because it's can be such a cold place, I think, from what I hear.
You know,
it's why I kind of hate being there, actually. But yeah,
it can be for sure. But I do find it can be if you're in a group of people who are like, I need to.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, Tom wrote on Monk for 10 years. I think he's fine.
He's basically figured it out. Yeah.
He seems to be doing okay. But yeah. I will say I have found the best scene.
Yeah.
I mean, I have found people who are devoted to making their art, even though it's not necessarily going to be a commercial art, who are weird, who are accommodating, who are lovely. Carolyn, my partner, is a musician, and so I've seen the people she's found in the music community on that end. And I, you know, I was taught to hate LA from my whole life because of a particular perception of it. And I can't believe how lovely and generous the communities I found here are.
Yeah, you described art as being a community activity. Yes. Recently.
Yeah.
That's great. I guess that's a testament to your own empathy once again, bringing it back to what we talked about at the beginning,
which I had to teach myself how to have.
Right, as did we all, because you start literally when you were like, oh, I started to think about being a tall man and what does that sound like when I'm loud, and I'm like, yeah, it comes down to like, would it, just thinking about what would it be like to experience me right now if I said this? And I've spent my entire life not thinking about that, just assuming that it was all genius. And then I'm like, gosh, that would be exhausting. And I need to really thank everyone I know for still hanging around.
Oh my God. Same. But yeah, I did forever. I did the whole like, well, this is how I am. And if you can't deal with it, what a prick. You know,
yeah,
like,
just maybe, be nicer. Yeah,
just be nicer, you idiot.
Just be kinder to people. People are doing their best, unless they're really not doing their best, like someone like Josh Hawley. But speaking of the election, who's your dad in the current election cycle that he's running? Well, is he? I don't know. God, what an asshole.
None.
You have no dads in the election? God, we're in a bleak place.
I don't, unfortunately.
I was trying to figure out how to answer this too. I was thinking, speaking of Gen Y, I'm like, it's got to be like 18-year-olds or something. Kids
yeah.
that are just like not
well, no,
freaked
you
out
know,
by trans people, just that
I
are
mean, my
dumb.
My dad are in the elections, I guess at this point, are the people who are showing up at campuses. Like, we're having a pretty 1968 moment, which
right
doesn't
now,
bode well
yeah.
for the national election necessarily, but like we're having and my dad and I used to talk about this, is he was furious about Bush, like George W. Furious. Could not, and I was like, Dad, I kind of feel like in one way or another, like we're getting close to where it's going to activate another sort of like late 60s moment, whatever. And it just never happened.
Yeah, right.
And then it's now happening real hard, right?
Yeah.
I wish he could have seen it.
What was the last movie that you saw and who was the dad in it? Or unless that's an episode of the podcast.
It is an episode. But you know what is great is I can rarely remember what I said in an episode, even if it was 10 minutes ago. What did I see last? What did we watch for the show last? We watched the movie Lake Placid, which is interesting because like usually we watch movies that are like rich in some sort of feeling. And we just did this one because it's a summer. It's a dumb, dumb summer movie. And in that, I'm going to pick Oliver Platt, who in this movie, they like make a sexy in the movie universe millionaire academic, which is a hilarious series of
weird
choices.
Okay.
I think it's the only movie that I think I've seen that has dared be like Oliver Platt is sexy, which I think is true. I think Oliver Platt is incredibly sexy, but he's always shown as like a nebbish dweeb.
Remember that show he was in, like, oh my God, on HBO like 20 years ago? Faith Prince was in it, the Broadway actor. And there was this kid, Anton Yelkin's lovely, this guy that was accidentally killed later on in a Volkswagen accident, but he was, and Hank Azaria.
I don't know this show. I got to check it out. I love Anton Yelkin. I got to check this out.
He's so lovely. And in Trollhunters, he was so good. It was such a great show. But Oliver Platt in this, and he has this he's, you know, drug-fueled maniac, but he had this intensely sexual relationship with Faith Prince. In that, so it's not surprising that you would say. He's so likable.
I think he's such a likable guy. I think he's great. And I think it's strange when... You know, I mean, it's a character actor thing, right? But I think it's strange when people who make the choices decide that you are not often going to be imbued with sexuality. I can't imagine I'm working on this mini series right now about Lyle Lovett.
Oh yeah,
and Lyle Lovett's trajectory in the media in the United States, at least, was in 1988. He released an album that was hard to define by way of genre. And everyone was like, this is great. What is it? Literally every article that came out, this is great. What is it? And then Lyle Lovett, with the exception of occasional appearances on Letterman, was not anywhere. And then he had this uggo. This is how the press is.
Oh, I remember.
Uggo had the gall to marry Julia Roberts. And that's how he was covered for a year. And I'm just curious about what that does to a person's self-conscious. What does it do that the people who make casting decisions decided that you are devoid of sex, Oliver Platt? And what does it do when everyone is like, how dare he marry our sweetheart who deserves so much more?
Yeah, it's so weird. It's so weird how much rage was okay until about 3 years ago. Remember how everything suddenly had to stop being such an asshole to celebrities? Like, they're not just canvases upon which you can project all your rage. God.
It's and then just to think about this person who it's like who wasn't even a celebrity, just a guy who made genre confusing songs.
And he was such an he's obviously still alive.
He's still alive.
He's an interesting looking guy too. He's sort of this tall Fido Dido-ish type, springy hair or something.
Yeah, so like a slender. He has like a springy pompadour.
Yeah, yeah.
It's certainly a choice.
It is a choice, and one we appreciate for what it is.
Yes,
for
Lyle.
for its genuine consistency.
You know who you remind me of so much is you remind me exactly of Sean Nelson.
Sean Nelson?
The singer of the band Harvey Danger. He and I are friends.
Okay.
And you guys, the cadence of how you present things and the intelligence you bring to it is you're very similar people.
Well, thank you for that. That's interesting.
Your presentation is your physical presentation is different, but your the way that you present is very similar.
That's fascinating to me. What I feel seen. No, thank you. I don't mean to be glib, and that's very nice of you.
No, I understand. What would one say?
I don't know.
To that thing.
Except to say thank you for both your time and your stories and your consideration and also the work that you do on your podcast, which I think is extremely easy to listen to and very fun. Yeah. I appreciate you, Alex, so much. Thank you
so much. I really appreciate it, Matt. Thanks for having me.
This podcast was created and produced by Aaron Hosier, Elizabeth Thompson, and Matthew Philp. You can always listen for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google, and anywhere you get your shows. Follow us at Tell Me About Your Father on Instagram and Facebook. Subscribe to our bi-weekly newsletter that accompanies new episodes at tellmeaboutyourfather.com. And Apple Podcasts is like the New York Times book review of platforms. So if you can, go there to rate and review us. We'd love to hear what you think.